Hi, welcome to today's episode of Impact EXP, where we bring you the most inspiring voices making a positive impact in our world. I'm your host, Jenna Nicholas, and today I have the pleasure of sitting down with my dear friend, Benji Fernandez, who's the founder and CEO of Nala. Nala is focused on building an impactful fintech company that's revolutionizing the way that payments are made to and from Africa. Benji is known affectionately as the Chief Eating Officer, and Benji's journey from a passionate Tanzanian entrepreneur to leading one of the most exciting fintech startups is nothing short of inspiring. Nala, under his leadership, is pioneering affordable, reliable, and fast international payments to over 11 African countries with ambitions to expand further. And his work is not just about creating a service, but also building a community through global events and direct engagement with the diaspora in the US, EU, UK. Nala is carving out a space for meaningful, real-world problem-solving in the financial sector. Backed by some of the world's most prestigious accelerators and VCs like Y Combinator, Bessemer, Accel, and with the support of influential angel investors, Nala is poised to tackle the vast, untapped potential of African payments. Benji is also a friend and classmate of mine from Stanford Business School, and I've also had the honor of being an investor in Nala. So Benji, thank you for being with us. And before diving into the fintech world, you started as a national television presenter in Tanzania. Can you share a bit about just your journey in becoming an entrepreneur and how your experiences have kind of been shaped moving forward?
Awesome. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on the show. I think you should be the national television presenter based on that introduction. Wow. I love it. No, seriously, that's very, you know, you've got it. You definitely have it. Oh, wait, what was the question?
Your journey as an entrepreneur, kind of what inspired you and what that looked like?
Cool. So I grew up in Tanzania, Dar es Salaam, and in East Africa. When I was 17, I got a scholarship that brought me to America for the first time for school. I'd never lived in the United States before. No, my family history had lived in the United States before. So my sister and I are the first in our family to go to university. And coming here, I moved to Minnesota all the way from East Africa. It was a huge culture shock for me, starting with the weather, but also like trying to adjust to norms in America were very challenging. It wasn't like they would be coming to America, I'll tell you that. And then, you know, shortly after that, began this career in television. So I used to be a TV host. So I started TV when I was 17, then did it every single summer throughout undergrad. So in Tanzania, I was like this TV personality. I come to school, I'm a regular student. It was quite a different balance for me to even, you know, look at that and balance that out as a regular student while trying to perform in class. But also back home, you have this public persona, which can be very, very distracting, especially at a young age. Now, at the age of 19, more money was growing in East Africa. And my boss with TV said, hey, can we work on this project to enable people to pay for a TV subscription on mobile money? And I was like, sure, like, you know, I'm not an expert on it, but I'm curious about the space anyway. And that was my first project in payments. We enabled people to pay for TV subscription on mobile money and through M-Pesa and DStv, which is the largest TV provider network in Africa. And that was a project I wrote about to go to business. So shortly after that, that's when we met. As you probably remember, I was a little child in business school. I think I was 21 there, like running the streets. But, you know, South Africa gave out a full scholarship to 8 African students a year. It was called the African Media Aid Fellowship. So I'd applied for that one. That's how I got to the Bay Area. My first time on campus ever was the orientation week. I'd never been for Advent weekend or anything like that. And I didn't think I was going to start a company when I came to school. I was, you know, quite young in the class relative to everybody else. You were really young as well, I remember. And that's probably what we bonded on a lot. But I think that the challenge was, I didn't see myself as an entrepreneur. I just saw myself as, hey, I'm not qualified enough. I don't have enough experience. I need more work. I don't have enough money. I don't think I can start this. I don't think I can lead people. These are all the questions that I had going on in my head. But it was actually classmates, people like Jenna, people who really challenged me within the classroom and outside of the classroom to really think differently about the problems I cared about. I would always complain about payments. I'd always complain about, oh, I wish we had service X, Y, or Z in Africa. I would help people do this. And my classmates would often come back to me and say, why don't you go and build it? And my response would be, oh, I don't have enough money. I don't have enough experience. I don't think I can be an entrepreneur. And being surrounded by so many people that just challenge you in that way really started to make you question, what if I actually try to do this? And I'd rather try and potentially fail and versus live my life and ask myself, what if 5 or 10 years later? Mm. That was the big push that got me to really start building Nala right after school.
Amazing, amazing. Quite a journey and really, really inspiring. And I'm curious, like now, you know, and obviously with all the ups and downs of entrepreneurship, like what continues to be a source of inspiration for you, like particularly in some of the harder moments?
Yeah, wow. The harder moments, they never end. You always think you go through one thing that's really difficult. And I'm sure you have a ton of these. And you're like, okay, can't get worse than that, surely. And then you move on and then something else happens. You're like, oh my goodness, I thought that was like rock bottom. I think we've had a lot of hard moments as a company. Like when I was starting out in Y Combinator, my co-founder left. He didn't want to move to Africa. Him and his wife, you know, it got to the point where I was like, pick their marriage over the company. And I think that was challenging, you know, where I started really questioning, hey, look, how am I going to build this company without my co-founder? I think lots of different challenges here that we had to pivot the business once, had to go through a large amount of layoffs at one point. And that was really hard for me to do as a founder, just trying to like people who had really bet on us and investors coming and telling me like, hey, do you know what? Maybe we throw in the towel here. I'll get your job at one of our portfolio companies, and really pushing back on saying, no, I think I can figure this out, you know, to evolving the business. I mean, in the last 18 months, we've grown 29X. As a business, revenue has gone 10x. So every single function broke at the company. So for example, a mistake in the treasury team a year ago used to cost us $3,000. A mistake today costs us $50,000. And so as a business evolves and scales, the problems get more complex. Therefore, the stress level also increases for you as the founder because the losses are way higher. You know, now you have 100 people on payroll. Like, if you don't make payroll, what's going to happen to the business? It's not just 100 people. They have families behind them that are relying on their income from the company. You have people, thousands of people who are using your service. If the service goes off, what happens to them? What happens to the money they're trying to send back to Africa and the money you're saving them already? So all of these, you know, the bigger we get, the question starts to really get to you. And I think what keeps me sane is two things. One is my faith. We've talked about faith a few times here and there. But you know, I'm Christian. I grew up Christian, and my parents never forced my faith on me. But, you know, throughout all my challenges that I personally faced, my faith has really kept me grounded and kept me sustained for where I need to go and what I need to be doing directly. And the second thing is the customers. So every time I think about the challenge we face, I also think about the customers who are serving. And I read the messages that they wrote to me or write to us as a team. I go into our customer support channel and I read those messages personally. Sometimes I respond to customers. People don't know they're talking to me. And they see my name, Benjamin. They're like, oh, is this really you? Or is this about my notes? Actually me. And I'll call the customers myself and speak to them. And I think hearing the problem and the need what we're solving for directly from customers keeps me really motivated. We're like often over and over again when we go to the child. And those are our endless.
No, amazing. I love that. And on the faith piece, and it's so powerful to see the role that that plays for you. I'm curious, like, how does that show up? Like, what does that look like for you?
Yeah. So I think when I'm going through a difficult moment, sometimes I try to separate myself and take the emotion out of it. I think that's the hardest part is not making it personal. When something difficult happens, it's like, okay, really take a step back, look at the big picture, which is so hard to do when you're going through. And I remember once last year, we were going through a very difficult situation at work, and I went to the board meeting. I was pretty down about it. And I started like questioning myself. I'm like, maybe I'm not as good as a CEO. Maybe it needs the question, like float through your head and your mind. And then I talked to my board member about the issue, and we had this board meeting, and he told me, he's like, Benji, this is the first time this has happened. And I was like, where that situation was happening. And I was like, yes. And he's like, well, deal with it and expect a lot more. And it was the best and the worst piece of feedback at the same time. Because it was the worst because that didn't help me fix the problem. And I was like,
thanks.
Yes, like, that's useless. But then it normalized that level of problem. And my board member who sat on boards of many large companies, like public and listed companies here in the US and fintech, she had seen these problems happen to those founders at scale. And so he said, it comes with the territory for where the business is heading. Across a certain threshold, like these are the new problems or the types of problems you can start facing. And that helped me a lot. And so like taking the emotional response out of it, now going back to my faith, I would take myself away and I'm like, okay, cool. I'm going to go sit far by myself and pray. God, like, help me understand, like, give me wisdom, give me strength, give me understanding. And just having a moment by myself where I could pray, read my Bible and on my own, that puts me, like, personally in another zen. And the problems, like, mentally, the moment I get it all over got over it mentally, I'm ready to start. Yeah. And not to say that I always like that the problems run away. No, they don't. If anything, they just keep happening. But I think that reminder over and over again. And it's hard because even as I leave the company, I feel for many different faiths. And I have to be respectful of everybody's faith and the organization. And, you know, I think that, you know, what I've really appreciated from Nico, my CTO and COO, they've always respected my faith. So sometimes mm-hmm. I'll be like, hey, guys, before we have this meeting between us three, I want to pray. Okay, cool. And
it's powerful.
And I think that just gives me that, you know, sustaining energy that I need.
No, that's huge. Thank you for sharing that. It's really powerful. And maybe you can share a bit more. You know, you've already done so much in terms of like reaching over 11 countries. Like, can you share a bit more about what are your goals? Like, what does success look like to you?
Oh, Jenna, I have so many goals. I mean, success is truly impacting the lives of millions of people trading with the African continent. So we're on a mission to build payments for the next billion. Like, if you look at the African continent today, there's 1.3 billion people. By 2050, it's going to be 2.5 billion people. Continent. The world's largest population is going to exist in Africa. And, you know, also the world's going to trade more with the region. So today, for example, Instagram influencers in America can get paid through their debit card and credit card directly. Influencers in Africa who are very talented. I know you love Afrobeats. But they can't get paid directly or other global services directly to their M-Pesa or mobile money accounts. And so I think there's whole economies that haven't even been created for Africans globally, where I try to think about this as an African. How can we open up through technology opportunities to create a whole new economy for income people in the African region? That's what true impact means. Are we using payments as a way to deliver other global financial services where global commerce businesses will come and trade, global trading companies import and export? For example, today, you have an iPhone here on the table, that the lithium ion battery in that iPhone comes from the Congo. It's imported to France and it's sold to China that's placed into your iPhone. Now, when is the transaction going to happen between the Congo and China directly?
Yeah.
I mean, or the Teslas that we see outside here in San Francisco, they have lithium ion batteries in them. They come from the Congo, imported to France, sold to the United States. Never exactly go from Congo directly to the United States. When, like, how do you trade directly for cross-border payments? Those are the questions that I think about impact. And what success should mean is, how do we reduce the cost of global trade to the African region? How do we increase the opportunities for people locally on the continent, therefore creating new income streams for them directly, but also saving them money on FX costs, loss, trade costs, loss, shortages that happen in the African continent. So those are the things that...
No, amazing. No, that's really, really amazing. And, you know, a lot of our work is around bias, and it feels like just in so many of those examples that you just shared there, it feels like bias that is embedded within our systems that has impeded the ability for like these direct transfers to take place and those direct relationships to take place. I'm curious how you think about that and like how you think about overcoming maybe some of these biases that are embedded within the systems in which we're operating within.
Gosh, Jenna, the biases start so many places. I remember when I was first fundraising here, I never built a company before. So a lot of my mentors are other founders, and I was going to fundraise after YC. And I remember one of the VCs here in San Francisco sat down with me, holding on the side as I was pitching to him. And he's like, hey, Benji, just one quick question. You know, the money's not for you, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, Yeah, it's not for me. It's like, no. Like, I want to make sure you know that. You know, it's not for you, right? And I was like, yeah, it's not for me. It's for knowledge. It's like, yeah, but it's not for you. So I was trying to understand what was he mean by not for me? Then he said, oh, like, not for you to personally spend. I'm like, yeah, but it's for the company. And as we left that meeting, I was wondering, I asked myself, does he ask that same question to other entrepreneurs here in the US? And how he was trying to frame it was like, oh, you know, I know VC funding is not that common in Africa. And so I just want to make sure we're on the same page of our line. And this is a well-known VC, well-known fund here in the Bay Area. And so if you talk about IC, you know, that was one of my first meetings. I was like, oh, like that's how it is. And then even, you know, you've been an investor in Nala, but, you know, over the last year at work, our field business has grown until like even we were doing a round recently. We got a term sheet by one fund, but other funds, we had given them a chance to give us a term sheet earlier and they didn't. But the moment I told them we got a term sheet, all of a sudden, magically, there was a fund that, for example, Jen, this happened a week and a half ago. A week and a half ago, a partner at that fund, a managing partner, sent me an email rejecting Nala. Like, okay, cool. Then there's a TechCrunch article that comes out about Nala last week. And then they sent another partner from that same fund reaching out saying, hey, we'd love to look at the deal. I'm like, wait, you just rejected us a week and a half. I would have more respect for that fund if that Andy partner said, hey, I think I was looking at this business wrong. Like, And so I think there's a lot of biases towards the region. I operate in the South African region. And what's funny is all of our revenue is generated in the United States. We make no revenue in Africa. Yeah. Well, our customers live in the US, UK, Europe, and send money to Africa. But because we service the region, quote unquote, Africa, there's this fear or this bias like, oh, it's poor, oh, it's dangerous. I'm like, okay, look at all the companies you've invested in here that have gone to nothing. And if you give like $5 million to somebody in across Africa, like you'd see how far that money will go. So I think those are some of the challenges where the best VCs are going to get rewarded long term. They'll make the right bets. Not based on biases. I mean, if you look at Latin America today is where Africa today is where Latin America was 10 years ago. So you think about Nubank and David Velez, like GSP here, like 10 years ago, him trying to raise money for Nubank was probably super hard. And probably a lot of people rejected him. But look at Nubank, last quarter's gross profit was $1 billion. And that's crazy. So I think that's going to be Africa over the next 5 to 10 years. People who are making those early bets, which are high risk on paper, sure. But will get rewarded very end year.
No, that's a really powerful analysis. And I'm curious, like, what advice you would have for aspiring entrepreneurs, especially in navigating some of these situations that you've had to navigate? Like, what advice would you have?
Wow. You know, if you are scared of rejection, you should never be an entrepreneur. Your whole life is full of rejection. You know, it's about like people not believing in you, people not wanting to use your service, from VCs not trying to give you money, from, you know, you're going to have so many doubters. And if you can't deal with doubters, then you should never be an entrepreneur. I think, you know, you're going to have a lot of people like not supporting what you're trying to do, and that's okay. There is a saying I always tell people, the knowledge team, I say, and I think it's a principle of life. I say, look, if you don't take responsibility, we take orders. And I think that's a principle of life.
Yeah.
If you don't take responsibility, like somebody who's working at a job and they want to get promoted, their boss is only going to promote them if they see them really stepping up and like taking the responsibility of even the role above them. Like, okay, you know what, Jenna? Here's a promotion.
Yeah.
I love what you're doing. I trust you more. You know, this is a build on trust. And trust it by saying you're going to do something, doing it, and repeating that. And then it compounds over time. The same way with entrepreneurship is if you don't, if you're never going to start, you're never going to get anywhere, even try. And it's easy for me to say, but I want to caveat and make very clear here. I didn't come from an entrepreneurship family where like people are building tech companies or anything like that, where I have VC-backed cousins, relatives. I have no family in America. I have no family in Europe. I have no family in the UK. We have over 100 employees in these markets. I'm like, they're known trying to build these companies. So it's a very, very, very lonely journey. And I think the most important thing is starting and beginning is always the hardest.
I love that. And I know you talked earlier about your faith, and I'm curious as it relates to like both those two themes that you just brought up of like rejection and loneliness. Like, are there ways that your like faith is helpful around that? Are there mantras or like things that you come back to that kind of help you in those moments when you're sort of dealing with that rejection or loneliness?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a Bible verse I really like. You know, it talks about too much is given, much is required. And, you know, I feel very privileged. Like, privilege is always relative. Everybody thinks they're not privileged. And I feel privileged compared to everybody else who I have to constantly. Like, by nature of statistics, if you have a university degree globally, like anywhere outside of Africa, you're in the most privileged 0.03% of Africans globally. There's less than 1% of people across the African population have a university degree.
Wow.
So just having a university degree anywhere, which is that privileged top 1%. Now everyone's like, oh, but I want to be like so-and-so because privileged drugs, people compare themselves to other people. So I recognize my privilege. I recognize by going to Stanford Business School, like I was the third Tanzanian ever to go to Stanford Business School, last from 2005, and it's sad that I was the third one only in history until today, since we graduated.
Wow.
From Tanzanian in 2015. It's 2024 right. Nearly 10 years. And the question that, as I think about this, and when you bring up moments, I recognize that privilege because I see, there are millions of people from Africa who will never get to sit even in this chair talking to you. And I recognize because I'm in that privileged spot, there is a large responsibility that I have to carry, not just for myself, not for my country, but for an entire region. If Benji doesn't do well, it's an entire region that's going to get written off by VCs. If a U.S. entrepreneur in California doesn't do well, okay, cool, it was just Irene, Rachel, David, who didn't perform well. But if a whole region is counting on like, oh, well, Excel back to Nala, and if I don't do well as an entrepreneur, you think Excel is going to invest again? Absolutely not. And so it brings those sort of pressure. But with that pressure, I recognize the privilege I have. I'm like, okay, I'm going to be grateful. And okay, until there's gratitude, gratitude is the foundation of
it. Yeah.
And so for me, I have to realize, okay, cool. You know, God's brought me all the way to purpose and the reason why I'm all the way. Now, I need to recognize that, but I also need to recognize the responsibility that comes with it. For me, praying and meditating is what helps me do that. There's no way I can do this.
Yeah, that's huge. Is there, I know that like so much of what you do in terms of like giving back is like facilitating workshops and like training and like, I'm curious, like what role you see that as part of the giving back, or like what does that giving back look like in practice for you?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, it's hard to do all the things I really want to do, especially if it's possible time, right? We always wish that we had more time to be able to do it and build many different things. And, you know, Jenna and I have talked about so many different projects she's worked on and so on. It's, you know, I'm always really inspired by all the workshops and things you can do it. Across the Tanzanian African continent, been a lot of trainings and workshops. So what we do is a lot of financial literacy training in rural regions across Africa. And, you know, what we notice is, especially when you train women, the region benefits way more. We're more patient with money. Like a lot of our most disciplined users are women. And they really try to take care of, you know, their responsibilities they have. So for example, to explain to the audience that are listening, who is a Nala customer? Nala customer, there's two types of customers that we see the most. One would be, let's say somebody was working at KPMG in Ghana, got promoted, got a job at KPMG New York, but they have their family all back home and they're sending like $1,000 a month back to support their mom, their dad, and their siblings every single month with their income that they're earning in New York. So that's one type of persona, the migrant. They're all in migrants. Second type of persona would be like maybe they came here for university 25 years ago. They've been living and working in the United States for the last 20 years. They've saved up a bunch of money. Now they're looking at retiring. They're in their high 50s. They're trying to build a home back in Africa. They're saving a lot of money. They're trying to maybe launch a small business here and there. Those are two personas we see a lot. Now, what's really fascinating is it's also really sad. I met a lot of our customers. Like, I remember this lady in London. She was about in her 60s. She came to the UK as a maid, house help. And she, when I met her, because I was asked a lot of feedback, she sends nearly 40% of her income home. I was like, why are you sending so much? So, Benji, the only thing keeping me living is my two sons. My two sons back in Kenya, the only thing my life and keeping myself here in the UK. She's working for her family. She doesn't get to see them every week. They can't fly. They don't even have a passport.
Yeah.
So her sons are like, you know, 18, 20. And so she's just trying to support but then get them to university and so on. And people like those really inspire me to like, that we do. And really think about how can we make this cheaper? How
can
every dollar or pound or euro go one step further, like 3% further for our customers. So I think that's, you know, with different trainings and programs that we try to do is bring people like that to like, okay, how are you using your income? How are you even spending this money? And where are you supporting other people around you? And it was hard. I think a lot of African migrants are more responsible to support their family, more required, not even responsible. More required. It's not even a choice. You're almost required. I personally still send money back to Tanzania every single month. And there's responsibilities I have and folks I need to take care of, relatives that aren't financially well off, like that I need to support. And, you know, these are things that I think that persona of people have more weight on than other people.
That's amazing. Thank you for sharing those stories. That really brings it to life. And I'm curious, like people who are listening, who are inspired and I want to be helpful and supportive, like how can people, listeners be helpful to you?
Thanks, Shana. I think there's a mix. So for example, we're hiring a lot in the US, in the UK, in Europe. So engineers, always hiring engineers or any backend engineers, that would be great. Going like always keen on that. I really think the team you build is the company you build. And, you know, making sure we're having really good people, solid people join the company who are just want to perform really well, but also care about the impact of what we're creating at business. Those people are solid and tend to be the best performers at Nala today. So I think if you have friends who might be interested in joining Nala, you know, across growth roles, compliance roles, engineering roles, product roles, those are roles that are open and we're hiring for. We have a couple operational roles as well. If they'd also like to work in Africa, like they want to spend 2-3 years in Africa, we have a few offices in Africa that they can come and like, hey, do a year in Nairobi, a year in Senegal, or a year in Egypt, or, you know, one of these markets, we can arrange those things as well. So definitely reach out to us. There's much roles on our website, but also paying our people as well. Other things they could do is if you are friends with African migrants in the U.S., UK, Europe, ask them, like, help us with product feedback. So, like, if they've heard of Nala and, you know, see if they can, you know, help us collect more product feedback. I'm always trying to make the product better and give us more product feedback for more people. Scaling a consumer business is very hard and very expensive. So, obviously, behind every voice, it could be up to 10 people.
Yeah.
So if you get one person, they could refer up to 10 people. So every person matters for us as a business. So for those people, like, let them know about Nala. I'd say those 2 to 3 things would be the biggest ones right now. You know, obviously with banking partnerships in the U.S., always trying to get more to work with. And it's also challenging because the moment you mentioned you did cross-border payments, every bank did panic. Okay, well, let's have a compliance discussion first and see, okay, what's your concern? And let's go through your concerns first before you panicking and turning us out. I think those are some of the things that we probably need to think about.
Amazing, amazing. Well, thank you so much, Benji. This is like always just so inspiring talking to you, and everything that you and your team are doing in the world is absolutely incredible. And I think just the ripple effect of what Nala is doing to, you know, reach people globally is so inspiring. And I know it will be very inspiring to our listeners as well. So thank you for taking the time. And as we launch our second season, we'd love to extend a heartfelt thank you also to our listeners for embarking on this journey and exploration with us. And we hope you'll take a moment to reflect on the incredible stories like Benji's and insightful conversations and profound lessons that we've learned along the way. And we'll hope you all can subscribe to our podcast. And, you know, we're committed to bringing you content that is not only informative, but also hopefully inspirational, and to really galvanize towards action in the world as well. So thank you again, Benji. And thank you so much to all of you for listening.
Awesome.
Brilliant.